You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a new conversation with award-winning and best-selling Scottish author Denise Mina, whose new book is The Long Drop, published in the States by Little Brown and Company. After a peripatetic childhood in Glasgow, Paris, London, Invergordon, Bergen, and Perth, Denise Mina left school early. Working in a number of dead-end jobs, all of them badly, according to her website, before studying at night school to get into Glasgow University Law School. Denise went on to study for a PhD at Strathclyde, misusing her student grant to write her first novel. This was Garnet Hill, published in 1998, which won the Crime Writers Association John Creasy Dagger for Best First Crime Novel. She has now published 12 novels and also writes short stories, plays, and graphic novels. In 2014, she was inducted into the Crime Writers Association Hall of Fame. Denise Mina presents TV and radio programs, as well as regularly appearing in the media, and has made a film about her own family. She regularly appears at literary festivals in the UK and abroad, leads masterclasses on writing, and was a judge for the Bailey's Prize for Women's Fiction 2014. Her new book, The Long Drop, is a standalone true crime thriller that exposes the dark hearts of the guilty and the innocent. True story, 1958, Glasgow. Peter Manuel broke into a suburban villa in Glasgow and murdered three members of the Watt family. William Watt, the father, a successful businessman and entrepreneur, was arrested and jailed for the crime, but the police couldn't find enough evidence to charge him, and he was released. Watt was determined to clear his own name and let it be known that he would pay for information. Peter Manuel contacted him and offered to help. The two men met in a bar and spent the next 12 hours drinking together. No one knows what happened that night. When Manuel was finally arrested weeks later on another murder charge, he represented himself in what the newspapers called the trial of the century. The Long Drop is Denise Mina's reimagining of the mysterious night Peter Manuel and William Watt spent together, intercut with the transcripted trial. Through a careful reconstruction of events, Mina's riveting prose attempts to make sense of one of the most baffling and intriguing true crime cases in legal history. The Long Drop is based on true events from the late 50s, and I think I read in an interview that your first work about this case was a play. Is that right?
Yes, it was. It was a play, and it was on in Glasgow. And it's a very strange kind of setup. It's a fantastic theatre near here, and they do a play, a pie, and a pint. It's lunchtime theatre. We have a one-hour play. And the guy who was the producer at the time was called Dave McLennan, and he was a very famous theatre producer here. And he was fantastic. And he would say things like, make it as odd as you want. You don't have to make it relatable or comprehensible, because people come anyway. People just buy a season ticket and come once a week. And, you know, we have lots of kitchen sink dramas on, and it doesn't matter if it's really disturbing, because it is a very disturbing story. So I put the play on, and it was full of the audience. I mean, it was sold out, the run, and it was full of pensioners. And the pensioners all said, you've told that story wrong. The real story is much more interesting. And then they told me the real story. And because there seems to be a court story about what happened in any particular criminal law case. And then there's the story that people tell each other about it. And because it was in the city and everybody knew people who were in the story, it was a much better story and much more plausible.
That's so interesting. So were you familiar with the case before you wrote the play? Is it very famous? Has everybody heard about it?
No, really weirdly. I think it's a bit of a source of shame in Glasgow. And people, you know, it was quite, people had forgotten about it. There's lots of big, big criminal cases people have slightly forgotten about. I think people feel a bit implicated. And there was a TV series on about it last September, apparently they couldn't get BBC Scotland to make it. They had to go to an outside producer. So it is a story that has been forgotten in lore until very, very recently.
Okay. So actually, the evolution of it reminds me a little bit of, are you familiar with Margaret Atwood's novel, Alias Grace?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So
Yeah.
I remember reading once that she had written a paper, I think as a student, she wrote a paper that sort of implicated the main character in Alias Grace. And then later she changed her mind and she decided that the woman was innocent and she wrote a novel taking the other side of it. And that's not exactly what you did, but you had one set of information when you started with the play and another set of information when you wrote the book. I thought that was really interesting.
I think that's an interesting process because you become so invested in the case.
Yeah,
because you have had an evolution in your own perception of the story. So you're much more engaged with it than you would be. You're imagining corners and what's in the cupboards in a way that you aren't if you come to it, if you write your first impression.
Right. Yeah. Now, was this the first time you've worked from an actual series of crimes or crime in your novels?
Well, usually I start off with a true crime case and then try and work out what's interesting about it. Steal those bits. So there was a case of a kid who had killed another kid, and it wasn't actually the Jamie Bulger case, but it was another case, and I sort of worked around that, but sort of trying to work out what the essence of a story is and then fit that into a narrative. But this was the first time I'd written one where everyone kept their names, where the circumstances were the same, where the milieu was the same.
And was that very different? Did it feel sort of freeing or like a risk or anything different?
It was really terrifying because it's a very strange structure. It's quite an odd story. It's true crime, but bits of it are quite funny. No one's particularly... it doesn't have a lot of the conventions that are a given in true crime. And, it sort of implicates people who are not here to answer back. So ethically, I think it takes a lot of chances. So it was really frightening, and I was very aware of the fact that I was doing something out with my own, oeuvre and something that might be regarded as kind of reprehensible. But I think also true crime is regarded as a very low form, and people aren't, familiar with... people who aren't maybe familiar with, high art versions of that, like In Cold Blood or Happy Like Murderers, find it very distasteful.
Yeah, why is that? I mean, everybody loves to read a good mystery, but is it just that we can separate ourselves from the reality of violence if it's not true?
Yeah, it's a really interesting, that sort of balking at true crime. I think that's really fascinating. And I think when you start working as an artist, you think you won't have to worry about social stratification so much because you're not working in university. And then you realise, oh my God, this whole endeavour is replete with social status and stratification. And one of those is the low art to high art ladder. And, having written comics, you become aware that it can change very dramatically, very quickly over time. And that something can be low art and then become very high art, and that readers are very invested in that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of literary books that I really love are difficult for people to read, and they strive only because they think they are going to access some truth about the world. And and I think true crime is regarded as very low art and regarded as, when I started writing comics, people thought it was an aid to literacy. So there weren't very many words in it.
Right, so you did the graphic novel for Girl with a Dragon Tattoo, right?
Yeah, and I also did a year-long series on Hellblazer.
Oh, right. Right, okay. Do you like that? Is that fun?
Oh, it's fantastic. And as a writing exercise, it's so interesting because... you can leave out so much, and as a prose writer you tend to think that you have to imply things, but readers are so familiar with the narrative form that they fill that in for you, and it becomes very clear when you're writing comics. It's such a spare form of storytelling.
Yeah, I've just done two interviews with graphic novelists, and they were my first two. I mean, I've been doing this show for years, and they were the first two interviews with graphic novelists, and I loved them. And I was like, wow, I should be talking to more of these people. It's really fun.
Yeah, and they're, really raw writers, because they're not, they talk about it in a different way, and they talk about it in a commercial venture type way, and they talk about, you know, turning pages for reveals and things like that, things that we don't think about, and maybe we should. Mm-hmm. It changes the way you cut your chapters up.
Let's talk a little bit about the long drop. I wanted to know, just as far as the real case was concerned, why were the police so focused on Watt? Is it William Watt?
William Watt.
Why were they so focused on him when he had an alibi?
Well, now, I only found this out afterwards. There are two surviving children from one of the victims, and they were furious about the TV show because they said William Watt was guilty of something and we don't know what, and we're sick of people saying that he was an innocent bystander. And they said that he went off fly fishing and all his family were killed that night, and they said that he took the family Labrador with him, who was a guard dog for the house. Now, if you've ever been fly fishing or seen a fly fisher, you know the last thing they want is a Labrador with them. They don't want that. And also, he was a very strange man. He presented as very, very strange. One of the journalists that I spoke to gave me a letter that he had published in their paper 2 days after the murders. And it's a very kind of overblown language, you know, you evil fiend. It's addressed to the murderer. And it says, you know, you evil fiend, you are sitting in a dark room, your head is in your hands, I will get you, you are evil, and all that. He just presented so, so badly. And, you know, any policeman who met that guy after his family had been killed would be suspicious. I mean, he just was a man who made you very, very suspicious. Yeah. And he said things like, the police are liars, which no one said in those days. And, you know, and he offered all this money, and he published a letter in the paper saying, I will pay for information, in exactly the same way that O.J. Simpson did after he was acquitted. And just everything he did looks really suspicious.
Yeah, he's a very strange, and you do a very good job of creating this very strange, awkward character. And not just because he gets very drunk for part, like, well, let's just talk about the structure. So you go back and forth between the night that he meets with Peter Manuel, which is another really bizarre thing to have done. Peter Manuel being the man who Watts suspects of killing his family. So he meets with him, and then you go back and forth between that and the court case. He's just so bizarre, and he's very awkward, and they get so drunk, but he's also just a very strange man, and I think you present him just very well. So,
having said that, it doesn't mean that he's guilty just because he's very strange.
No, that's true.
You know, which is, but he was quite bizarre, and he would make statements like, I have never told a lie in my life, in court under oath. Things that make you very, very suspicious. And, you know, I mean, I think they had a bit in common. I think the murderer and William Watt, neither of them really understood how they were coming over to people.
Right. This seems like a good time to mention this line from the book. At a certain point, Watt is watching Peter Manuel, and this is his sense. This is a quote. Manuel doesn't seem embarrassed. He is so unembarrassed that Watt is confused. He searches his face for twitches of defiance, but has the strange sensation that Manuel doesn't feel anything at all. I thought that was such a great line. It's very early in the story, and it just sets up Peter Manuel's character as, I assume, sort of a sociopath, but also, just a really bizarre person.
Very odd. The kids in the local area called him Mr. Twitchy Eyes. He would look over your head and his eyes would twitch about. And he had all these mannerisms that were basically of a detective in an American movie. You know, kind of shooting the cuffs and making stupid statements and things like that. Just very, very weird. I mean, a lot of the language that those guys adopted was Humphrey Bogart and James Cagney.
Well, I was wondering about that. I was wondering if you were trying to reflect the vocabulary of the time, or if it was a little movie-fied. You know, there are points where they talk about broads and dames, and I was like, wow, do people really talk like that all the time?
They still do here. So when the book went to London to be edited, they were saying things like, you know, people wouldn't really call each other guy, which we do.
Okay.
And they wouldn't say janitor, which we do. They wouldn't say things like dames and broads, which guys of that generation did.
Yeah.
So, and I think one of the reasons American films influenced the language here so much was that all the English films, working class people were always servants or sidekicks. But in American cinema, they were the action figures, working class guys. So people here really adopted that language. And they would, you know, they adopted the dress style. You know, dance was enormous here. Everybody met their partner at the dance, and people would go ballroom dancing because of Fred Astaire.
That's fun.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's a huge thing here.
The other thing, this is just a really tiny thing, but one moment when I was reading it, and one of your characters says something is down to somebody, and I was like, oh, you know, here we would say that was up to somebody. You know, it's up to you. It's so interesting to wonder how that changed, or, you know, where it came from. It's anyway. All right, so was Peter Manuel very handsome?
Well, he was handsome until he smiled, but he had a mouth full of teeth that looked like tombstones.
Okay.
So he was actually quite handsome, and, you know, he had hair, and his eyes were in the right place, and he worked in heavy industry here. It wasn't hard to be handsome. He actually is quite handsome if you see pictures of him.
Because there's a moment where you mentioned that the entire trial, all of the viewing public that came into the courtroom are women. That was so bizarre.
Isn't that bizarre? Nobody could understand why. And but, you know, there's something about the theatre of rape trials that is really fascinating. And given the conviction rates over here are so, so low, I don't know what they're like over there. But who is that theatre for? And who, you know, I mean, my strong feeling is that it's a signal to women, that rape trials really are a signal to women not to get drunk or wear short skirts. Or I don't really know what it means, to be honest with you. Mm. But the papers really struggled with the fact that most of the viewing public at the Manuel trial were women, and they didn't know what to make of it, and they couldn't construct femininity in a way. I mean, we still have this conversation. Why are the majority of women people who read crime women, as if we're very, very uncomfortable about it? I mean, we don't ask that about thrillers. Why are most of the readers men?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, it's just when women do something that isn't about having a baby or breastfeeding, it's taken to be out with their ambit of areas of interest. I mean, I'm sure there's lots and lots of reasons for that. But I think he was quite good looking. And it was, you know, maybe that it was, you know, women are quite ghoulish.
Yeah, I sort of prefer, now that we've talked about all of this, I sort of prefer to think of them as being there to sort of like intimidate him.
I think they were there for a jolly day out with their pals, because that's why most people go to court trials, is it's something in the papers, and, you know, it's something they can get interested in. And but if you ever go to court and hang about, it's mostly pensioners. It's people who have the time.
Do you go to court very much in order to sort of take notes and do your research?
Yeah, you're not allowed to take notes, though, unless you're a journalist, because apparently sometimes people go and they make notes of what the witnesses say and then tell the next witness so they can repeat it. So we're quite strict about that. But a lot of my family are lawyers, and they all say, I've got a good case on, why don't you come and see it? I mean, it's cheap theatre. It's rotten theatre. It's really dull. It's so dull. But I was there one day and I met the journalist who covers all the high court trials for all the press in Scotland, because most of it's drunk people stabbing each other, you know.
Yeah.
It's very occasional you get one good case.
Oh, that's, well, you had some great observations about the court. Like I really loved, it was his lawyer's name really Grieve?
Yes, it was.
Oh,
yeah.
My goodness. And he's unfortunately is inexperienced. He comes across as very wooden and not very likable. And it just made me realize the importance of the likability of counsel. And you know, I mean, everybody sort of feels like we're so great that we have this system where everybody gets a lawyer, but you don't necessarily get a very good one. So
and you know, it, having been through law school, a lot of lawyers, you know, I saw a lawyer at a parents' evening council meeting, and he stood up and did a law talk, and he was doing these gestures with his hands where he sort of, you know, made a temple of his fingers and got the person to repeat back what they were saying because it was foolish. And you just realise, God, there's so many bad lawyers around.
Yeah.
And it's a very particular way to speak about things. And you know, and no one's going to stand up, no one's going to give you a review and say that was rubbish, you could do better.
Now, did you ever practice law?
No, I didn't. I dropped out before I went into practice and became a barmaid, and then went on to do a PhD.
Okay. All right. Let's go back to the plot of the book a little bit. So it was really bizarre that William Watt met with Manuel, Peter Manuel. They went out for a night of supposedly, you know, talking about the case, and Manuel was going to tell him about somebody else who had committed the murders. And they end up just basically carousing and sort of almost becoming like buddies. But there's a lot that happens. So anyway, I'm wondering what people make of this. Did a lot of people see them out that night?
Well, no, I don't think they were seen by that many people. And William Watt would have been quite famous at the time because he was all over the papers. But the people, the sort of people that they, the company they hung about in, wouldn't really have been, you know, that interested in sort of dubbing them up. But when Peter Manuel was defending himself in court, he called William Watt as a witness. He called him back. He'd already given evidence.
Yeah.
And he asked him very specifically about that night in the different places they'd gone. And they're so shifty. I think they went to a strip club because at one point, you know, Manuel asks William Watt, have you always been faithful to your wife? And things, just really funky questions, really weird questions. And you know, I could sort of place where they were that night, but there's about 3 hours missing at the end when they leave William Watt's brother's house, and it takes them 3 hours to make a 10-minute drive. And so I think something strange happened then, but most of it is factually based.
You're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. This is an interview with Scottish author Denise Mina. We're streaming on 99.3wbtv.org. Before I continue the interview, I just want to mention that in the next part of our conversation, Denise Mina and I discuss the fact that Peter Manuel called his mother to testify, and she did him no favors. She refused to confirm his assertion that police might have forged his signature on a confession. And 4 different times, she reiterated that on the night he was arrested, Peter told her he didn't know what made him do terrible things. So that's a little context for what we're about to talk about next.
Now, your court scenes, are those all taken from transcripts, or did you deviate from what was actually said in court?
Some of that I deviated from, but a lot of it is basically a transcript.
Yeah.
So, Peter Manuel's mother,
yeah,
that is almost word for word what she said.
Oh my, that's unbelievable.
And she did say it 4 times, and you know, the longer you sit with it, the more you think, is she the only person telling the truth, or is she telling a lie that will get her son hung?
Right.
And if she is telling the truth, what is compelling her to tell the truth?
Right.
She's an extraordinary character, and she never moved from that house. She didn't need to, because everybody knew she was a good person.
My God.
Yeah, I know.
All right. Let's see. I wanted to just mention, you write fantastic drunk characters. I wondered if I could just read a few little things. So here's one part. Watt barely remembers that O'Neill was even there. All that remains is the shape of the name in his mouth, like a memory of a flavor. He goes back to what he was saying before. This is after somebody came into the bar, talked to him, and left. And immediately, he's forgotten he was there. Then outside, Manuel is walking down Crown Street. He has drunk a lot, and his legs are moving faster than he means them to. He's falling forwards, catching his weight with the next step, falling towards the river, and it goes on. And then my favorite was this one. Manuel shakes 2 cigarettes out of his packet and gives one to Watt. He lights a match, and they take their time, no rush, trying to make contact with the flame. It takes a while. Wow, if I didn't know better, I'd think you've been drunk before. Oh, no, it was so great. Those were so, you know, and it's funny. I know that you write with a lot of humor in a lot, you know, many of your characters are funny in previous books I've read. And so I wondered how you would do that in here. This is so sort of grim and serious, but you did. And I was really, just noticing where you were able to bring humor in and it wouldn't be inappropriate and it would just enliven the characters. I thought that was sort of one example of that.
But you know, it's funny because that only works for some people. So sometimes, you know, sometimes I'll read a bit in, say, Finland and people laugh, and then I read it out in California and someone came up and gave me a card for a therapist because you thought I was depressed. Recently, I was doing a reading, and I can't remember what I said, but I was sort of talking about something, and I said, you know, we'll all be dead soon, and the audience started applauding and laughing, and I couldn't really understand it, and someone shouted from the back, "We're all Scandinavian." So that doesn't play the same everywhere. You have to have quite a dark sense of humour for those things to work. You must have some Scandinavian in your family or your sense of humour or something.
Yeah, we were all Irish, but I guess we're pretty dark.
Oh,
sometimes.
That works as well. That works as well.
Is this true? Selecting suspects out of a lineup, people have to actually go forward and touch them?
Yeah, that was true then. Yeah.
It's not true now.
No, not anymore. But in those days, lineups were crazy. Because basically the cops, you know, would, I mean, there was very little rule of law. So lineups could be 30 people or it could be two. And basically if you just pointed at somebody, the cops could pull someone else out and say, this is the person you picked when you got to court. So they introduced this rule that you have to walk up to them and touch them on the hand and say, this is the person that I saw in the car or whatever.
I imagine that that must have made those selections drop significantly.
Oh, my God, how scary. I mean, imagine if it was a rape case.
Right.
And go up and touch the person and say, this is the person who hit me with a brick. And the woman who was raped and did stand evidence and it was not proven, she did still live in the same area.
Wow.
And Peter Manuel's mum, dad did spit at her. And she couldn't move out because that's social housing there. So it would be like, you know, you couldn't just leave and go and live someplace else because you had nowhere else to live.
Mm. Now, I wanted to ask you about the religious aspect of life in Glasgow. And you know, at that time, it seemed so, there was so much focus on religion, Catholics and Protestants and the classification of belief and background. Is that changing now? Is that a lot different now?
It's very different now. But I suspect it's very different to me, particularly because I'm middle class. I'm more middle class than my mum's family were. So they, for example, they never talked about the Manuel case at the time, even though it happened half a mile from their house because he was Catholic. You know, so I mean, I wonder what the parallels are with the Muslim community now when something, you know, awful happens in the Muslim community, how suspicious you would be and how uncomfortable you would be even owning that, you know.
Right. But
one of the things that I have noticed is there's a brilliant filmmaker over here called Peter Mullen, and he makes very Catholic films with lots of biblical references. And reviewers in Scotland do not get it. They just don't understand the scope of reference because most of the journalists are Protestant. And so sometimes you do see those big gaps. You know, he won a big prize in Spain for one of his films, and over here all the reviews said it's very confused.
So that's so interesting. So that's why Paddy Meehan would have stood out in her journalistic career, because she was Catholic.
She would have stuck out like a sore thumb back in the day because people could tell you were Catholic by the clothes that you wore. For example, a Protestant would never wear green.
Wow.
Yeah, I know, but it's those tiny social signals that people are picking up on.
The narration in the book is omniscient, for the most part. There was this wonderful scene, though, where they go to William Watt's brother's home, and it's still omniscient, but we sort of zoom into the head of John Watt's wife, who is out in the hallway listening to their conversation. And I really enjoyed that, and I wondered, did you see that as a shift in narration, or...
Yeah, I mean, it was going into, you know, from an omniscient story tip, which I really love, and it's quite rare to read that now, you know, and I really like that. It makes me feel like I'm being told a story. But to specifically look at it from the point of view of someone whose narrative structures are filmic, and to, you know, make it personal from, because they just, one of the problems with the story is there are very few women in it and all the women are silent. Mm. And so I wanted to in the middle of the night, look at someone who was completely powerless and look at her point of view in the story.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that part. I'm curious about your loving omniscient narration. Do you find it hard to do omniscient narration or not?
Well, you're kind of assuming that the reader wants to hear from you. which is a bit uncomfortable and a bit arrogant. But if you're telling a difficult story, you know, it's easier to temper it. It's just about taking ownership, and it really is about taking a reader's hand. And it's very sort of, you know, I read a lot of Zola at one time, and, you know, I really love that about him and Balzac. And I really love the scope it gives you as a writer to tell a story like that. You know, I think it lets you step back a little bit and sort of ease the reader into a difficult story sometimes, and then give them breaks like that. And Mr. Cook, who's the father of one of the girls who's been killed. And it just gives you a completely different scope, you know?
Yeah. There's a moment then also that becomes sort of meta. You're in this scene in the courtroom, and let's see, Watt has obviously been coached in his evidence, as have many of the witnesses. Startling to a modern reader is the frequency with which witnesses ask lawyers if they should say this bit now or interrupt their own evidence to point out that the prosecution has forgotten to prompt them into the bit of story that they practiced together. First of all, that was very funny, but also startling to a modern reader, just sort of was like, whoa,
yeah.
Now we're all reading together.
And there is one line that I nearly took out, and then I thought, no, I'm going to leave that in there. Have you read Jane Gardam?
No.
She's a really startling writer. And you know that bit where you're reading someone and you suddenly think, oh, you can't do that? Yeah. Oh, my God, you can do that. And she breaks into script format sometimes. She's doesn't give a shit. She's really amazing. And there's a line in it where Peter Manuel's presenting his own defence, and he thinks he's coming over well, and you know, he thinks that people understand him as a powerful man. And then I wrote, people think he's nuts, and I thought, you can't put that in there. And then I thought, no, you can put that in there, because you are telling a story.
Yeah,
you really balk at that kind of thing. But I think sometimes it's nice, just it's like you're giving the reader's hand a squeeze.
Yes, absolutely. I had a very funny, like, personal moment reading this book. Recently, a friend of mine, a writing friend, was complaining that everybody wants to be a writer now, and, like, her dentist is a writer now, and everybody wants to be a writer, and she's just feeling very dejected about this. I'm reading your book, and Peter Manuel wants to be a writer. He writes stories. I laughed out loud. I'm like, oh, my God.
As did John Wayne Gacy. As did Ted Bundy.
All right.
Is it? Because it's not, you know, you from the way you talk, I think you want to be a writer because you love writing and reading. But some people want to be writers and they don't read.
Right.
What do you imagine it is? I mean, you know, you're really just face to face with your own limitations all the time. It's not glamorous.
Right. Yeah.
Do you know, I don't know what people imagine it is.
And then a little while later, there's this great moment where William Watt tells Manuel he can't tell a story. He's basically, I think, telling him, you don't know how to deliver a story.
Yeah.
And he's not talking about him as a writer. He's drunk and he's forgotten. He considers himself a writer. But Manuel is so hurt. And it was just this great moment because, of course, anyone who considers him or herself a writer would be terribly hurt by that statement.
Totally crushed by that. They all tell stories. My mum's a great storyteller, but she's too detailed, and you feel like you should be able to say, stop banging on about details and get on with the story, but you can't, because it would be such a crushing thing to say to somebody. You can't tell a story.
Especially now that you're such a bossy pants, you know it all, so you don't want to say that to your mother.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't dare.
You just mentioned the author that you were reading. What's her name that you said? It was so fantastic. She breaks the rule.
Jane Gardam.
Okay, great.
She wrote a series of books called About Old Filth. It's a trilogy.
Okay, all right. So one of my questions was, what have you read lately that you would recommend to listeners? So that sounds like one. Is there anything else that you would recommend?
The Red Parts by Maggie Nelson just came out here.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Time ago there. And also, I've never read Dennis Johnson, and he just died yesterday.
Yeah.
So I'm reading him at the moment.
Have you read Bluettes also by by Maggie Nelson also? Bluettes.
Is it good?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. And then what are you writing now?
I'm writing a story about a woman who becomes obsessed with a podcast, and her life has fallen apart, and she's sort of, I don't know if you ever self-medicate, read, where the only thing that's keeping you going is you've got something to read.
Yeah.
And, you know, sometimes you're nursing someone, or, you know, you're depressed or whatever, or, you know, a relationship's broken up. Well, it's about that. It's about that experience of, you know, choosing narrative as a kind of medication. So she's obsessively listening to this podcast, and she just drops her life and goes off and tries to solve this true crime podcast.
Oh, cool. That's great. I was going to say, I'll give you $10 to make it my podcast. But it sounds like it can't be. Damn it. All right. Nobody gets obsessed with writing podcasts.
Oh, I'm sure we do.
No, that sounds really interesting. That sounds great. And so is it in her narrative point of view, or do you switch around, or how is it looking so far?
God, it's just awful at the moment. It's just, I'm sort of halfway through and I don't know what I'm doing. But no, there's an omniscient narrator who's telling the podcast story, and she is mostly from her point of view. And basically she opened the door and her best friend's standing there with the suitcase, and she looks up and her husband is standing there with the suitcase, and she knows everything. Mm-hmm. And she's left in this giant house, and her best friend's husband turns up and says, let's just sell her rings and go off and have an adventure. So that's what they go off and do.
Oh, that's great. I love that.
Yeah, I know. It's quite thrilling, but I don't know what they're going off to do. So,
did you listen to the podcast Serial, and have you heard the new one that they did, S-Town?
Oh, yeah, I heard it. Yeah, did you hear it? Did you like it?
I loved it. I loved it, Serial. And then the second year I didn't get into as much. And then the most recent one is S-Town, and I loved it. So good.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just such a, yeah, surprise at every turn. So.
I love this because, you know, it has those true crime teasers, but it's nothing to do with crime.
No, that's true. I kept expecting it to go back to some of the stuff he said at the beginning. It never did. So. There's a great line in the book, good storytelling is all about what's left in and what's left out and the order in which the facts are presented. And that's actually a statement about Dowdle, who's Watt's lawyer, who is, it sounds like he's a much better lawyer than Grieve, and he knows how to shape a narrative to pull in a jury. But actually, the line itself made me wonder about your revision process, and I wondered if you have any advice for listeners who are writers about revising a draft.
Be forgiving of yourself. I struggle with the committee on my shoulder who think everything is crap. Mm. Literally, I mean, I really, and I meet a lot of people who are crippled by that, by the inner critic. You know, I've published books that people really loved, and my last thought was, it's got two good jokes in it. And I think you have to be critical to make it better, but don't get lost in that. That's the main thing.
Okay.
I'm just going. I mean, it is an act of faith telling a story, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's great. So I just want to mention again, the name of the book is The Long Drop, a novel by Denise Mina, and it's published by Little Brown in the United States. Denise, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thanks for having me, Sheila.
You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and that was an interview with award-winning Scottish author Denise Mina. Her new true crime novel, The Long Drop, came out this spring from Little Brown. This week's Write the Book prompt was generously suggested by Denise Mina. She says, if you don't know what to write, start with the most explosive thing you can think of, and then follow all the shards. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. Tune in next week to hear a live interview with Vermont author Bill Schubart, whose new novel is Lila and Theron, Charles Michael Publishing. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as podcasts. For example, I first spoke with today's guest, Denise Mina, in February of 2013, and you'll be able to find that conversation if you go to the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com, and you can also find about 400 others. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And then, of course, you can stream the show live each week at 993wbtv.org. That's every Monday at 3. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont. Have a great week.